Masks are off and there is more awareness of the fact that the international law is very much limited in implementation depending who calls the shots.
It's more obvious to more people that the way these international courts have been functioning for long is highly questionable.
Is that gap between the law in books and the law in action at a breaking point?
Who is allowed to declare international law dead and who is still trying to defend it?
Welcome to Dead Men Walking, the new podcast series produced by IFIT in collaboration with Justice Info. Are today's global institutions and norms for peace, democracy, and human rights, most of which were built in the last century, still alive? Or are they just dead men walking? This is the uncomfortable question at the heart of this podcast series, Dead Men Walking. At a time of deepening polarization, geopolitical fragmentation and declining trust in institutions, this podcast aims to open space for honest reflection and serious thinking, not only about the problems facing the current world order, but also about the new ideas and innovations needed to shape what comes next. I'm Mark Freeman, the executive director of IFIT and your host for today's episode, in which we will turn our attention to the subject of international law and ask whether it is at risk of becoming, or is already, a dead man walking. And to explore this question, I'm really delighted to be joined by three friends and outstanding guest experts from the IFIT Global Network. Professor Sarah Nowen, who is a professor of public international law, currently at the European University Institute and on leave from the University of Cambridge. Sarah has a combined very rigorous scholarship together with direct field experience and recently served as editor-in-chief of the European Journal of International Law. She is a member of IFIT's expert advisory group for our peace treaty initiative, as well as a member of our law and peace practice group.
Thanks for welcoming us.
Shahrazad Akbar is one of Afghanistan's most prominent human rights defenders. She served as chairperson of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission from 2019 until the Taliban takeover in 2021, when she was forced, like so many, into exile. She's currently the founder and executive director of Rawadari, an Afghan civil society organization that monitors human rights violations. And she's also a visiting scholar at Oxford's Wolfson College. Shahrazad is also a member of IFIT's International Advisory Council.
It's great to be here with all of you.
And last but not least, we'll also have in this conversation Thierry Crouvelier, who is the editor-in-chief of Justice Info, the world's leading news website on international justice, and our partner for the Dead Men Walking series. For about 30 years, he has reported on trials for crimes against humanity and genocide from Rwanda to Sierra Leone, and the former Yugoslavia to Cambodia and Colombia. And he's also the author of three books about these and many other field experiences that he had as a journalist and as a writer. And Thierry is a member of IFIT's Depolarization Community of Practice.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
So with all that out of the way, let me again say a very warm welcome to all of you. It's wonderful to have the three of you together for this conversation. Well, we're going to dive right into this. And to kick things off, Sarah, let me maybe first get your overall take. And let's talk a little bit technically about international law. I think most people know international law covers very, very wide ranging areas, from the oceans to trade, climate, and literally dozens of other subjects. But most of international law, I think we might agree, is pretty dull. It just exists in the background of life. We don't really pay much attention to it. However, when it comes to the international law that relates to human rights, which has to do with the international law, let's say the duties that states owe citizens, or when we talk about international law in relation to conflict issues and the use of force, which, if you like, I would say is sort of a way of thinking about the international law that deals with duties owed by states to other states, Sarah's, is really just to ask whether international law, in the way that I've just mentioned it, you know, as it relates to human rights and the use of force, are people right to see this as being in a state of crisis?
Well, of course, It's my professional duty to challenge the portrayal of part of international law as dull. It's all very interesting and dynamic. I agree with you that some of the human rights law and the use of force is very much on the foreground in the sense of media coverage. And it's why? Because it's related to what we often see as spectacular violence and it gets the attention. But there are two important things. First of all, many of these other areas of international law really go about shaping people's lives. International investment law determines whether a state can regulate certain areas, yes or no, or whether they fear investors. That has direct impact on what kind of food people can have on the table. Similarly with trade. So this background-foreground distinction, I'm not entirely persuaded by. But what is a difference is indeed whether something is spectacular violence or spectacular violation or not. There's a lot of talk about crisis at the moment, and I think we have to be careful for a few reasons. First of all, we don't get newspaper headlines every day that international law in these areas is respected. Of course, we do get newspaper headlines when there are blatant violations, and we have seen blatant violations. Invasion of Ukraine, recent Iran attack, Venezuela. It goes on and on. But again, it's important also to look at earlier violations that didn't receive as much attention. Targeted killings were manifest violations very often of either prohibition on the use of force, humanitarian law, or the human rights law. And precisely because it received less attention, because they weren't so spectacular, they actually managed or helped erode the norms. Now, in a way, the whole history of international law is often told in the words of crisis and renewal. And we can go on and on and on and on about that. In some ways, what is currently happening is not so fundamentally different from the past. One thing, what is different is that in the most recent years, especially when we look at the Trump administration, is that they do not use the language of international law to justify their actions. In the past, there was even at least an attempt to justify it. Now the whole language of international law, especially by President Trump, is thrown out of the window. I don't care about international law. I care about my own moral judgment. But I'm not sure that we can declare a whole field dead only because one violator declares it to be dead. So the question should also be asked, who is allowed to declare international law dead and who is still trying to defend it?
Those are some very interesting bits of ideas for us to continue with. And just before I turn to you, Shahrzad, I recently learned an expression that I hadn't heard of called presentism, which is the bias of viewing the past through the present. And so I guess there's one of the elements that you're commenting on there is you're asking, you're pushing back. You're not so sure there's a crisis. Let's turn now to you, Shahrzad, and let me ask you a version of the same question. I mean, you and I actually met when you were trying to raise human rights issues in the context of the intra-Afghan talks before the Taliban takeover. And today you work directly still with Afghan victims, survivors, and human rights communities. So maybe just from the field, from what you're doing day to day, what is the perception? Is there a perception of a crisis of international law that you see in your own work?
Thank you, Mark. I think there has been a perception, a clear understanding and perception of limitations of international law long before Taliban took over Afghanistan, actually, in our work with survivors inside Afghanistan. Because in the 20 years of the Republic era as well, we saw how international law was limited in addressing violations when they were committed by the truly powerful. Not that the text of law was limited, but the fact that the politics around implementing the law was very different depending on who was committing the violations. The very clear example of this for the Afghan context was that the allegations of abuse by international forces, for instance, would be much harder to get attention and to get follow-up and investigation compared to violations of international humanitarian law, targeting of civilians or harm to civilians by the Taliban at that time. For us as the Independent Human Rights Commission or for us as Afghan human rights defenders, all violations and all victims were equally important and we tried to raise our voice for everyone. But how far did our voice go with the diplomatic community, with the United Nations, really depended on who was committing these atrocities. So I think, unfortunately, because of the history of what's going on in Afghanistan, the survivor communities in Afghanistan have perhaps a more realistic understanding of the limitations of the international law and the way that law works, where, the law's on paper, incredible. And of course, it's an incredible tool. It can be an empowering tool for survivors and for communities that have been harmed. But it is in implementing that law that we face limitations. And those limitations, a lot of it come from the politics of, you know, how violations are being perceived. What is the language that's framing them? Who are the perpetrators? Who are the victims and survivors? And I think in that sense, I don't know if it's a crisis, but that has been an inherent challenge. With survivors' experience of international law, who does it serve? How accessible it is? And who is being heard? Who is being seen? Whose atrocities are being documented? And whose losses are being documented, compensated, you know, addressed? That has been something that has been the challenge that we have been working with for a long time now. And that's a challenge that I think survivors are acutely aware. And this whole narrative about, of course, I think it has come more to the foreground now, this conversation about double standards, about, you know, international law being attacked by President Trump very clearly. Afghanistan, for instance, has an investigation, open investigation with the International Criminal Court. With the first Trump presidency, even a bit into Biden presidency, we saw, you know, the U.S.'s response to International Criminal Court and fear that the International Criminal Court might hold the U.S. responsible. What I want to say is that some of this is not entirely new, but a lot of it is now much more public. It makes our work harder because there is less faith, because the masks are off and there is more awareness of the fact that the international law is very much limited in implementation, depending who calls the shots.
Well, thank you very much, Shahrzad. And indeed, I mean, that idea of the law in books versus the law in action. I mean, I remember even as a young law student many decades ago, I won't say my age, but I remember always learning about that distinction. And I was taught that there's also a point that where the gap between the law in the books and the law in action becomes such an extreme, too extreme a gap, the whole thing collapses. And again, we can come back to this, but there's certainly a tension there. And I suppose, you know, is that gap between the law in books and the law in action at a breaking point? But we'll come back to you and Sarah in a moment. Let me turn to you now, Thierry. And, you know, your first book was about Rwanda and the genocide and the aftermath of the genocide back in 1994. And here we are in 2026. And, you know, you've been covering these issues intimately and intellectually for decades now. Is this moment categorically different in your view? How do you answer that first question about whether this is some kind of new, categorically different crisis for international law today?
I think if I were to be honest, yes. Clear to me that the way I have felt as a journalist covering these things since a year ago has been definitely different. And at the same time, I would be a bit like Sarah. It's never been as interesting as it is today. Like, I've never felt as busy as I am today. So in that sense, it would be hard to of course, say that it's dead, because if the field was dead, then I wouldn't have any work. And I feel like I have never had so much work. So it's different. It's clearly a different period of time where you can see, you can feel that everything that seemed to be the normal in the past 30 years, which wasn't before that, is no longer very normal. And so I tend to agree with Sarah that we always need to be careful about this feeling of crisis, because it's often misleading. But it's clear today that I think I have, obviously, I have far more questions than answers these days, as is probably the case for many in today's world and at the speed at which events develop. There are two things I think that create that feeling. The first is what Sarah was mentioning, which is the return of aggression and annexations. I mean, it's striking to me that we were counting between 1830 and 1945. Someone counted that there were 150 annexations. It was the order of the day. And then since 1945 up to, let's say, the invasion of Crimea, the annexation of Crimea by Russia, there were five. So clearly we had moved to a different legal order. And right now you can count up to 10, 12 cases of active aggression, annexation, or public threats of it that are really significant. So it would be hard not to say that the order has changed. The second thing that struck me more recently is when you look at the most recent peace negotiations and peace accords, and Mark, you're a far better expert than I am on this subject, it strikes me how we used to have automatic provision that would deal with justice or the respect of, you know, international humanitarian law. And even it could be symbolic, it could be hypocritical, but it was there. And in the most recent cases, I don't see it anymore. So that legal order, that is more the one that I am working on, seems to be on the retreat. So there's another thing that troubles me, and I don't know if it's a bit too broad for our conversation here, but I think, you know, experts like Sarah would have perhaps things to tell us that would also help us to understand what is the crisis that we're talking about. Sometimes I just wonder to what extent the crisis of international law that is talked about everywhere is a phenomenon on its own, like, you know, some sort of indigenous evolutionary process, or to what extent can we analyze it more in connection with at least three other major aspects of the current global turmoil? And I'm thinking very briefly about the climate and environment crisis that has seemed to reach a tipping point, the full advance of a particularly violent form of capitalism that started to develop 45 years ago. And third, the end of a long historical cycle of domination by, let's say, the Europeans, Americans, Western world, a domination that won't easily and peacefully go. So these are some of my, you know, mixed remarks.
We could speak for days, I think, between the different issues that all three of you have raised, but I want to pivot very specifically to, you had made a reference early in this conversation, Sarah, to the idea that international law develops through these cycles of crisis and renewal. And I guess, you know, for listeners, I mean, many may think immediately and rightly to the end of the Second World War, Holocaust occurred, etc. And the UN Charter was established, the era of the UN Charter was established. There was a prohibition on the use of force. Human rights emerged as a norm, the Genocide Convention and all those things. And I suppose the question I want to ask is, if a crisis of that magnitude is what led to the renewal that began immediately after the end of the Second World War, does this moment feel anything like that? And even if it doesn't, I guess the question I want to get to is whether we're in that level of crisis or not, and whether the gap is as big as it may, you know, as Shahrzad and others have commented, what would a renewal agenda look like? Just the last part of the question, this is a very long question. I apologize. But I suppose it's hard to escape the feeling that there was something utopian in the UN Charter vision of international law. The idea that through law you could prohibit the use of force. Does the renewal require us, you know, to become a lot more realistic in our understanding of what can and can't be achieved through international law? Do we have to accept that the utopia that was imagined by some, or it seems embedded a little bit in some of the ideals of international law, was always a bridge too far?
So the crisis renewal, in a way, I challenge that narrative, because the key question that we haven't discussed yet is from whose perspective? And I think Shahrzad's answer already began to illustrate this, that from the Afghan perspective, the lack of enforcement of some parts of international law are not so new, depending on who committed violations of international law. And similarly with World War II, yes, in many ways it was an enormous renewal. On the other hand, the UN Charter did not end colonialism in and of itself. You know, so from the perspective of a large part of the world, the UN Charter was not such a new order. There was also a lot of continuity. And similarly now, international law, yes, it may be violated in many ways, but international law as the system that underpins, to refer to one of Thierry's points, the whole system of global capitalism, and international law does support that system and enables it and allows it, for better or for worse, depending where you stand. That seems to continue. So I think we really need to look at from in whose perspective is there a crisis, and also from whose perspective do we think about rupture or change. Now, that then also reflects to or speaks to your question about reform. One thing I found really interesting is that the moment that the US started attacking intensified its attacks on multilateralism. And as an aside, I think we shouldn't conflate international law and multilateralism. International law can work through multilateralism, but there's also a lot of bilateral international law, a lot of regional international law. So international law doesn't depend on multilateralism. Anyway, when the US began to attack the courts in The Hague, with which Thierry is very familiar, a group of Global South states came together, the Hague Group, to defend international law. And also, if we look at the interesting many cases before these courts recently, they've been driven by the Global South. South Africa versus Israel, Nicaragua versus Germany, the Gambia versus Myanmar. The climate change advisory opinion was driven by the Global South. So in a way, and that brings me back to the point I made earlier, we have to be very, very careful that we do not allow the main violators to call this international law that. And in a way, that is also my problem with the Carney speech, which was kind of part of this narrative of the previous order, is that we're moving to a new order. Carney referred to great powers and middle powers. But the moment you speak of middle powers, it suggests there's also something else. There's a small power because something needs to be in the middle. And there was no reference to that at all. And I think that what for reform is needed is not just this alliance of middle powers, but it's really also an alliance between the middle powers and these small powers. Speaking of utopian.
Shahrzad, Thierry, feel free to jump in and on this point as well. What do we need reform to the very concept of international law? Maybe this is just an overdue catch up with people who have long not felt served by international law, not seen it as something that is for them.
I think I'm much more sensitive to that second part of the argument because, as Sarah said, this is one of the most interesting things that we've seen most recently, and which is also why I can't help connecting it to this idea that there's also a crisis of other aspects, including that long historical cycle that we are witnessing the end of, which is the domination of the West, is that exact countries from what we call the Global South have been using these norms much more recently than ever before what I have seen. And that's extremely interesting. And so in that sense, I don't really necessarily have a feeling when it comes like to international public law that reform of norms are necessary, or at least I don't know which ones. I have a different view on international criminal law that I think requires a lot of reform, and that's been for a while. So we are paying the lack of attention that international NGOs and most actors in the field have sometimes consciously ignored the extraordinary problematic functioning of international criminal law. And so the fact that it is more challenged now or more obvious how limited and biased and ill-conceived it is, the better. It's good news to me. And that is, in a way, I don't know if it's in the making, which is why it's a bit frustrating at the moment. Like, I don't see an alternative that is well-framed and well-phrased. What seems to be clear to me is that it's more obvious to more people that the way these international courts have been functioning for long is highly questionable and should be reformed like quickly, and maybe won't be reformed from inside, but alternatives will come from other levels. I'm also referring to what Sarah says, that, hey, there's the regional level, there's the local level, where a lot is happening that is far more creative than what we see at the level of international institutions. But as I'm much less of an expert of international public law, what I see when it comes to war, when it comes to, you know, norms that have been established to regulate the relationship between states and nations, and that is broken by the current world leaders, for some reason, and I might be wrong, I don't see what norms should be really reformed. I think they look to me as pretty strong and still valuable and useful to regulate these relationships and this the violent dimension of states.
Thank you, Thierry. I'm going to just give Shahrzad a chance to react to what Thierry and Sarah have said, and I'm going to then move us to a closing question. But over to you, Shahrzad.
Thank you. I think, Mark, I mean, picking up maybe both on both speakers a little bit, when I look from the perspective of survivors, when I look from the perspective of those enduring most serious violations of international law, it's just one tool. And we are looking on a And it's a very important one, but it's also one with a lot of limitations. And so I think we are constantly looking at everything that's out there that we can utilize, the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court in case of Afghanistan, the UN Special Rapporteurs, investigative mechanisms, knowing full well that none of this is sufficient on its own, or even all of them together to address the situation, because it is, of course, also a deeply political situation. So what are the other tools that we can look at and bring them together? And I think what we have in our experience in the past few years, what we have seen with the situation in Afghanistan is that, you know, different tools may have legitimacy with different audiences. It might help us mobilize different audiences. So you also look at the audiences that you're working with. For instance, we have, in case of Afghanistan, we have multiple international accountability mechanisms active or due to be active. But we know that with certain audiences, when we are working with the Taliban, when we are working in the region, we need more tools. And so last year, a group of us organized the first People's Tribunal on Women of Afghanistan. And through organizing a People's Tribunal, which is not a formal, you know, a formal legal mechanism, we could bring in discussions around women's rights in Islam, because we are talking about not only just language of law, international law. Taliban are very easily dismissive of that, but it's much harder for them to dismiss when they're challenged on a religious, you know, on a religious terrain or religious framework. So different, and also it allows us, when we take the judgment of the People's Tribunal, we can take it to many more people in the region to mobilize. Even governments would feel less hesitant than if we go and tell them, you know, two Taliban, there are arrest warrants issued for two Taliban leaders by the ICC. They may not have a good relationship with the ICC, or may think it's a, you know, colonial institution, whatever. So, but the ICC arrest warrants work with some other audiences that are keen to uphold, you know, international law in that way. So when we are talking to, you know, some of the diplomats in states, we say, aren't you nervous about normalizing a government, a regime that has ICC arrest warrants out for it? So I think when you are in that position, when you're trying to, you're in a very difficult, catastrophic position, human rights of systematic violation of human rights, of essentially a gender apartheid for us, you look at everything. And I think what I have learned is that we can't just rely on international law. And, you know, it's good to educate ourselves and to utilize those mechanisms, but also be very aware of its limitations. And the most important thing is really mobilizing political power, people power. You know, these rules, these mechanisms have, for me, it is to what extent I can utilize this judgment, this verdict, this arrest warrant to build alliances, to get more people stand up for my cause. And, you know, which language works with some people? Will people be horrified and shocked to hear, you know, arrest warrants are out, there's this international crime happening, I have to join this cause, I have to stand up for these people, or do I need something else? Do I need to put something else on the table? How do I prevent the normalization of the outrage that's going on in my country? And, you know, in some ways, international law is a useful, despite the crisis, the challenge, it is a useful tool, but it is insufficient. And I just want to say one more point to Sarah's, you know, the point that Sarah made about regional actors. For instance, for us, South Africa is so important. Afghan human rights community, because of the role that they have recently played in international accountability mechanisms, we are desperately trying to get more alliances, get Spain to speak out more for women of Afghanistan and get them more active in accountability fronts at the ICJ case, because we know having Spain means it's easier to get Muslim countries on board. And having Muslim countries on board means that our messages will go further with the Taliban, the perpetrator that we are dealing with. So it's also good to see how, you know, maybe some actors stepping back, maybe the US stepping back is unhelpful. Of course, it's unhelpful in so many areas. But for us in Afghanistan, maybe it can be helpful. Maybe it provides an opportunity for us to build an alliance in our case. Because guess who was blocking an investigative mechanism on Afghanistan for years? The US. And once they stepped out of the council, it was much easier for us to get the investigative mechanism that we wanted.
Those are very important points. And I want to segue from that to maybe just a final, I'm going to try and do it as a provocation, because I wouldn't want to end a conversation about international law, you know, in which we're asked the question, is it a dead man walking, without talking about own goals by international law advocates, things that we've done, we who practice international law, we who may believe in some of these UN charter norms, whether it's human rights or the rules on the use of force, just to mention the two very obvious areas. I want to just invite any reflection you'd like to share, just maybe one example, one story about things that you've observed, or maybe that we collectively have done, who maybe adhere to and subscribe to these norms that have actually hurt the cause of international law. And then secondly, I'm going to also provoke in a different area. I think each of you has mentioned current U.S. administration. But if we're looking at sheer fatalities, if we're looking at the greatest malefactors, each year it's increasingly non-state armed groups. And I suppose if we're going to talk about perceived or actual enemies of international law, I mean, you talk of the Taliban as the government, but of course it began life as a non-state armed group, a terrorist group. So I guess one of the other questions is, what do any of you have, you know, as a reflection, how much have these other enemies of international law that don't believe themselves, they'll say openly, we are not bound. Hamas says we are not bound by international law. Just take an example. Then it's a widespread phenomenon. So how much of international law actually has some vulnerabilities that can actually quite easily be gained by the non-state armed groups or criminal cartels that are not held to the same standards of account? The focus of international law in the areas we're talking about is mostly on states. So those are two provocations. You can add reflections, provocations of your own. Feel free to disagree, but I didn't want to end a conversation without introducing those two additional reflections. So who would like to strongly disagree or agree or add to what I've just shared?
Let's change the order to be provocative.
Sure. Shahrzad, your final thoughts.
Well, I think, Mark, I think a lot about this question of that I raised initially, the distance between practice and law, you know, because as a human rights activist, as a social political activist in Afghanistan, when I was growing up as a young person, I was so keen for my country to sign up to all the conventions. And we really worked hard, you know, the broader Afghan human rights community, many pioneers before me worked really hard to make sure that Afghanistan signed up to these international conventions. And the next step was really trying to get our laws aligned with them. I do feel like we missed a lot in this kind of, we just focused a lot on kind of on improving our legal framework and not enough on improving the institutions, but also more importantly, increasing the demand for law, the demand for rights, in the sense that I think we should have divided our energy and our forces, and some of us should have really gone out village to village, myself included, should have gone out village to village community and really had honest conversations with people about, you know, what do these norms mean to them? And is there demand for them? Is there understanding for them? Because I think it's hard to sustain norms unless there's a strong democratic demand for them. I mean, it's not just in Afghanistan. Everywhere in the world, I worry about the future of human rights in the UK, where I live, with the rise in right-wing politics. I worry about the discourse, you know, the racist discourse around Muslims. I worry about the racist discourse around people of color, about if you keep improving the laws, but if you can't also at the same time work on building that demand and building that enforcement, not just enforcement through police, through force, but through people adapting these international norms, as their values and seeing value in them. I think that's something that we really missed badly in Afghanistan in the journey that we had. And I think that's what I have been trying to focus in our work in the past few years. You know, where do we bridge? Where do we go? We can't go to people and say, accept these norms as they are. There's no negotiation and it will improve your life for the better. There has to be a more of an exchange. And part of it is really breaking it down, because all these documents are also written in very fancy language, very detached from reality of people's lives. But as we talked in this podcast, international law is, you know, when you leave your house and go and take a bus and go to the library and check out a book and, you know, your daughter goes to school, all of these things are because of international laws and domestic laws, and they are present in every day and they are important to protect. Otherwise, we will lose them. And the protection comes from people and communities mobilizing to really preserve them and fight for them.
That's a very strong plea for the normative side. Thank you very much, Shahrzad. And Sarah, Thierry, do you have any final quick reflection that you'd like to share before we close out?
I think I have a bit of a split personality when I listen to you, because I know there's a part of me these days that want to keep in mind that some of these norms and some of these principles really stand. And actually, we're going to go back to them. I mean, I don't see at some point, I don't see better order that human beings have invented than the legal order to organize relations between states in a way that it avoids war, it prevents more wars. In that sense, I think the figures I gave about aggression and annexations are pretty strong. There was that order that seemed to be not applying to everyone, but at the global level, it helped having less of these massive confrontations. And so that I do believe that, of course, it's challenged now, but we'll go back to it. And so there's a period of time during which you keep them alive because they sort of make sense still to me. And then the other part of my personality is like, oh, what an opportunity to get rid of so many things that look so bad and so rooted in our civilization and our set of cultural norms and beliefs, that I am extremely excited that this is challenged. And I take it very positive, including when it comes to thinking about some institutions may not stand. I don't mind. I mean, I agree with Shahnaraza that it's good to have as multiple tools as we can, but some of them may die and we won't do work. So I don't know if it's a quick answer, but that's where I am today. I want to be open to extreme creativity and challenges, and at the same time not being blind to what was strong and useful and proved to be rather efficient in what was set in 1945.
I'm tempted to say before hearing Sarah that is actually the idea of a dead man walking. It's being dead and alive at the same time. It's schizophrenic. Sarah, final word to you.
Yeah, I wonder how to put this in the words of dead man and walking and live and dead at the same time. I think another differentiation is important, and that is international law as a system, which I think still continues, but it will evolve. Like international law in the days of Hugo Grotius is not the same international law as the one we have today. The other one is one of the specific norms. Now, do the specific norms need reform? Yes. I mean, why does the UN Charter say that France has a right to a Security Council seat in this day and age? There are all kinds of rules in the international legal system that are absolutely required and in need of reform. So defense of international law as a system need not be a defense of international law and all its specific rules, let alone institutions. Now, you asked specifically about lawyers undermining international law. And in a way, we have seen that over the years through legal argumentation. I mean, that's the nice thing of law. Law is a language, and you very often can argue one thing and you can also argue the opposite. I mean, that's what parties always try to do. And that's why I'm also saying we shouldn't focus only on today's administrations, but also the previous ones. So if we, for instance, look at the torture memos, Guantanamo Bay, the targeted killings, humanitarian intervention, Kosovo, all of these episodes created narratives in the language of international law that many would say were in violation of international law. And it's notable that that language is now being picked up by many, for instance, by Putin when he invaded Ukraine. Now, it was even less kind of convincing in that case, but one can see this erosion through particular types of arguments. Finally, about the non-state armed actors, I'm not immediately sure that international law is to blame for this per se. Look, international law binds non-state armed actors in the sense of international humanitarian law and international criminal law if certain conditions have been fulfilled. Then you could say, well, international law should do more. Traditionally, it was the case that international law didn't do so because they really fell under the state's jurisdiction. Now, what we are seeing is that the state is perhaps too weak to deal with the non-state armed actors, so that international law needs to step in as a backup. But I would argue that's even more the case for transnational corporations, because transnational corporations are also not very directly regulated by international law, but also manage to escape the domestic legal order or to make most of kind of this allocation of jurisdiction that international law does, to take all the benefits of international law and none of the obligations. And that is also governing our world. So in that sense, I agree with you that international law perhaps needs to do more with respect to non-state actors because of the globalizing world. I'm not sure that it's only, but it's limited to armed actors or criminal gangs.
I'm sad to end the conversation here, but I must. So just allow me to thank each of you, Sarah, Thierry, Shahrzad. Really appreciated all your insights and your own provocations. And there was some interesting disagreement as well in some areas, and I guess it's not dead yet. I guess we can say it's not dead yet, and I will leave it to the listeners to decide whether international law is a dead man walking, but it's not dead yet. So again, thank you so much, and thank you as well to our listeners. We look forward to your joining us for the next episode of Dead Men Walking, when we will turn our gaze to another of the 20th century's core norms and institutions for peace, democracy, and human rights, and ask whether they are similarly dead men walking. Thank you so much. Dead Men Walking.